Hey everyone, you're back with Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. For this episode, I sat down with author Robert Reddick for his new book, Sidewinders, the sequel to his 2018 book, Master Assassins. This one comes out on July 6th, and I am very excited to check it out. For this interview, we look at where the book picks up, where all the characters are, and give a few hints as to what folks can expect. Now, Robert has had the chance to travel all over the world, and that comes into play in the book. We talk all about the settings he created, the world building, and just how long he spent doing that before actually writing Master Assassins. We also look at fantasy as a genre, how far it's come over the years, and some more changes that really need to happen. And joining me now, well, we first spoke to him back in Boscon of 2018, a magical year before everything just went all topsy-turvy. I am talking to author Robert Reddick for his soon-to-be-released book, Sidewinders, out on July 6th. Robert, welcome back. It's great to have you here.
It's terrific to be back, Max.
All right. So for the folks at home who aren't really familiar with the series, which kicked off with Master Assassins, give us a quick rundown as to the overall story here.
Well, sure. So it's easy to begin telling, and then like a branching tree, it gets really big. But the trunk is easily described. We've got two brothers, peasant boys, and draftees in a war they don't want anything to do with. They're swept into this mad and terrible religious war, and they want out. And in book one, at great cost, they find a way out. And because they're the heart of it, you need to know just a bit about them to know what kind of a book you're reading. So we have Condry, who's very grounded. He's the kind of guy you feel good when he's by your side. You think, you know, you're in a safer place with Condry with you than not. Although he's got his flaws and he's got his secrets and so on, because perfect people are awfully dull. But his brother, oh boy, his brother is so far from perfect that, you know, the word doesn't remotely apply. I mean, Mektu is a train wreck. I had an editor early on say, "You can't put him in your book. He's too awful. He's too much of a jackass. People are going to hate him. He's a crazy pig, you know." And he is all that. And he's also the runaway favorite character in this big cast of characters. So it's funny how that works. I mean, I think editors are very often right. But you do have to have your own instinct. And once in a while, you have to say, I think I'm going the right way anyway. And so here we have these two in book one, Master Assassins 2018, as you said. They get into all kinds of terrible trouble. And without getting lost in the weeds, I can say that involves the murder of the favorite son of their own people's messiah. And to escape the instant condemnation that comes down on their heads because of that, they have only one direction they can run, and that is straight into the continent's most lethal desert. It's a place called the Sumurdath Jal, which means the ravenous lands. And it's twice the size of the Sahara. It's the only part of the country that their people's messiah does not immediately control. And it's their only chance to live, but it's a desperate gamble. So throughout book one, we're following those adventures. In book two, they're in the desert, and the canvas broadens really quickly. We get, the brothers remain at the core of the story, but in this one, you see a lot more than they ever could see. You know, being raised in a small village, and this was fun to work with as a writer, they don't know a lot about the world. They have heard things. A lot of it is untrue. Some of it's true. But they just haven't seen very much. And that was, as I say, that was really a great precept to work with, because when you're seeing through the eyes of someone who hasn't seen a lot of things before, it gives you license and responsibility as a writer to make it all feel very, very fresh. So that was great for book one. Now we have both the perspective from the brothers, but we have people in other parts of this imagined continent of Urath. We have a retired general who's a military genius, but who's blackmailed back into service by his own country and people within that country itching to start a war. We have this gifted young woman who is the youngest chancellor of a 3,000-year-old city whose rulers don't understand that it is only her brilliance and her tireless work that is keeping the city from being destroyed. And there's this looming sense that every day that they are sleepwalking, the princes and the royals around her, the doom of the city is getting closer. And a few other perspectives, and what's fun is that all of these threads are slowly coming together in the same place, which is indeed that city. But our heroes have to get across the desert to get there. And getting across that desert is a lot of what goes on in Sidewinders.
Okay. So certainly a lot happening here. Now, I know that when it comes to fantasy, world building is an essential part. And some folks I know have spent years just building the world, the people, even like the languages and the religions to make it as complete as possible. How long did you have to spend for Master Assassins? And did you have to do any more for Sidewinders?
A long time. and a lot more for Master Assassins. You know, it's funny, I've been thinking about this in a totally, with new vocabulary in my head for the last week or so, because there's a wonderful writer named Jeffrey Ford. A lot of, you may have met him at Boscone. He's an old friend of the Northeast and just a terrific writer, short stories only. And he put up, you know, Jeff is never someone who shies away from a strong opinion, and he just tore down the whole kind of, let's say, religion of world building among us epic fantasy writers the other day. He said, you know, that term is, all it does is evoke an obligation to drudgery. And he says, and, you know, I hear the word world building, and the sound in my head is the dull, stolid clomp of nerdism. If I was actually sitting across the table from him, I'd have a lot of arguments there, you know, a good friendly argument. But I think what he's getting at is that there's this notion that can be taken too far, that we, you know, that we just become cartographers, you know, and we sit down and we map and we fill notebooks just like we did when we were dungeon masters back in the day, you know, for week after week, year after year after year, before we write a word. And unless you have all of that mapped out, you shouldn't be, you know, trying to tell your fiction in the fantasy world. And I think Jeff was saying, you know, that's not true. And I certainly think that that's an exaggeration as well, because what you need to have is the world alive in your imagination and solid enough in your imagination so that when you're telling the story, you create a perfectly airtight envelope of belief. And that belief first inside yourself. You know, if you're not believing in the fictional dream, then your readers won't be, of course. But if you are, then you don't have to know what, you know, the face on the postage stamp in the bottom drawer of the king's courier is, you know. Because if you need to know that, your imagination is going to tell you what that is in the scene where the drawer opens. Until then, you don't need to know that. You need characters that are alive, that are vital, that are moving, that are active, and you need all of that to be consistent. So yeah, there are some notebooks to fill, there are some maps to draw, but that's a long-winded way to answer you. I mean, what I do is I tell the story moving forward like I'm going through a thicket in the woods, and you can see a certain distance into that thicket, but you can't see everything, and you don't need to as long as you keep moving forward.
How do you know when you're done?
I don't, because I don't wait to be done to be writing. I mean, what I know is if I'm trying to write a chapter and I feel lost, like there's no, you know, like I'm treading water and there's no solid ground under my feet, then I'm not ready to do it. But it isn't a mistake to start trying, because you know, if you're wading in and you suddenly think, oh no, I'm in over my head, just wade back out and take some more notes, do some more thinking, and do it again. But no, I, and you know, another thing that is, I think, easy to overlook is that if you decide too much too soon, there's a danger of making yourself bored when it comes to actually telling the story. And this too is a careful balance you have to hit, because if you're winging it, it'll show. You know, if you're just making crap up, it's going to show. But if everything is worked out to the point where you're sort of just executing a plan that's already nailed down, then the sort of joy of discovery that needs to permeate every day you sit down to write can be reduced too much too. And, you know, I sort of found that, at least this is true for myself, and I found it over time. If I don't surprise myself to some degree every time I sit down to write, then it's just no fun, and I think the readers would feel that. Mm-hmm. You know, I was writing today about somebody asked me to write about a favorite scene, and I realized when I was finishing up my little essay, this was a huge scene. It was like right in the middle of Sidewinders, this crazy chase scene, you know, with five different parties, and they're up on a wall that's kind of like a highway in the sky with dunes on one side and a cliff on the other, and you know, it's really fun to write and so on. And you know, they run for like 50 straight hours. I think I added it up, you know, some on horses and some on camels and some on these saber-toothed rideable cats, and just crazy, crazy, crazy scene. When I got done, I realized, you know, I didn't plan that scene. What I did was want that scene. I wanted it so badly. I wanted it as a reader, and I wanted it in my book as a writer. And that gave me the focus to imagine it, you know, enough in advance with a drawing of the wall with, you know, here's where this happens and so on, but enough that was loose that just came out in the writing to keep it alive. So no, you're never done. You know, you're just ready at some point. You're ready to run with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier that Mech 2 is basically just this like human train wreck of a person, and that initially your editor had wanted it gone, like everyone loves him. Did that surprise you?
Well, it surprised me first when he said, you can't put him in your book. And then, it surprised me somewhat that he was so popular because, I mean, he's crazy. He really is a nut. But there are a lot of nuts in the book. I guess that you don't spend as much time up close and personal with them all. And the fact that he's the close brother, I mean, they're 3 days apart in age. They're actually half brothers, but they never called each other that because they're so close. So, you know, they have different mothers, but they're born 3 days apart. They're absolutely inseparable. They fight like a couple of terriers all the time, and they can't live without each other. But his brother Condri, you know, the even-keeled one, is who we see everything through when we're in the brother's perspective. So that means all of book one, and a good 60% of book two, this Sidewinders that's coming out. And so, you know, I thought people were going to like him, but that they would, you know, and I'm sure there are readers out there, and I'm waiting with some dread for the day I see this review when somebody's just going to say, he's too much of an asshole. I can't deal. I just can't deal. You know, and I will say, you know, another pro who read an early draft and really grateful to so many early readers of Sidewinders said, he's terrible about women, Mech 2. And he is sometimes, you know, but I really appreciated that because I went back and I looked at it and you know, this gets into a very big and very important subject for me, which is, you know, I consider myself a feminist. I mean, it's a hard word to live up to, and I don't like to brag about it, but it's something I aspire to. And I want this book to be a book that is very sensitive in gender terms. And at the same time, I just know at an instinctive level that I have to write flawed characters. So, you know, one of the warnings I got about Mech 2 is, boy, he's just, you know, he can be really stupid around women and say offensive things. And I knew that. But I'm glad that somebody pointed that out early because, in truth be told, I was a little scared when he made his debut in Master Assassins, you know, among, you know, what if everybody hates him? And in particular, what if women readers hate him and people who are, like I try to be really sensitive to issues of feminism hate him? But actually, that was not the case. And it was very, very satisfying that, I mean, he can be very misogynist. Other people in the book can be very misogynist. And I wanted that on the page because I wanted misogyny to be a subject that I explored and took seriously. I wanted it to be something that, because it exists in war, and this is a war story, it exists in people, you know, and again, as I said, I didn't want perfect characters. So, yeah, you know, and I think that what I did was own his flaws, both in, you know, how he treats the women in his life, how he responds to them, the idiot he can be, and you know, also the, because he's not just that. There's moments of real grace in him too, you know. And again, you know, just like a perfect person would be boring, an absolute buffoon would be of no interest to anyone. But so I surprised always, but mostly just relieved that people saw what I was trying to do with him. That he was a very flawed person, nonetheless has strengths, and that he's a good foil for other people in the story. So I'm feeling good about him, and it seems like readers, men, women, both really feel that way too. So it's satisfying.
Okay. Do you feel that fantasy as a genre is a little unique with these issues of misogyny, or is it more prevalent in other genres too?
Wow, what a good question. And I wish I could say that I had thought about that as long as the subject merits. So it depends, I suppose, on what genre you're looking at. And then there's the debate of, is literary fiction a genre or is it a mode? You know, I mean, I think historically science fiction and fantasy have some issues with that that are really pronounced. I'm not enough of a reader of, say, crime fiction or romance or westerns to speak to that with a lot of knowledge. I wish I could, because I think it's, you know, you're going to get me doing some research of my own here to answer that. But we have a history that we have to own up to, and it's not just history, it's very current. I mean, it happens all the time. You know, go on some of the most thoughtful and professional science fiction discussion groups, and you'll see things that just make you want to cringe, you know, that make you want to crawl under the table and say, I don't know these people, that's not my kin. But, you know, of course it is a big tent, and you know, those are our kin, and we have a lot to learn still, and a lot of self-reflection that I think, you know, can never stop. So it probably isn't that unique, but when I say that, I don't want to downplay it, because it's really important, and we've got a long way to go yet.
I think especially when it comes to fantasy, there's the old school trope of, like, you know, the princess always has to be the one getting saved, and she's never in any kind of, like, strong position. She's always, like, the helpless one, and, like, the heroes are almost always guys, and if there are women, they're always in a more, like, secondary or, like, third banana role.
Yeah, in the classics, for sure. And then often just, you know, sexualized and objectified to a really grotesque degree. And there always have been exceptions, wonderful exceptions, written by both men and women, but more often by women. It's, again, it's something that is part of where we come from as a tradition, and we have to own up to it and do better. You know, that's, I think, what a lot of us are really trying to do. And it also, you know, it stands between a lot of readers today and a lot of books, both current and classic.
Do you think that extends also to the authors? Are there a lot of female fantasy authors who are really getting attention?
Oh, many, and for the best of reasons. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just so many gifted writers out there. I mean, Sophia Samatar, Aliette Bodard, K.V. Johansson, you know, Claire Cooney, just wonderful gifted writers, you know, Rebecca Roanhorse, go on and on and on and on. In so many other categories of identity, we are more open than we were. Again, long way to go. But one of the very finest and most encouraging things for me is just how much more open the gates are, and, you know, how quickly the readership has responded with this immense hunger for all kinds of tales told by all kinds of people. And there are growing pains there too. You know, I think that publishers have sometimes been guilty of saying, you know, not of taking, you know, really gifted people, but not giving them as much respect as they deserve, and saying, okay, where's the next ethnic wonder? You know, and how can we package them up as a sort of sensationalized, exoticized this or that?
Yeah.
The authors don't, you know, don't put up with that much, but you can see the effort to make it happen sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And again, you know, and people will point out to this the phenomenon of the marked and the unmarked. You know, if you find, you know, you're reading a book and it says the woman soldier did X, the woman guard did this, you know, do you ever see the man soldier did that? You know, no. And yeah, you know, long way to go. Lots yet to do. And, you know, I consider myself always in a process of trying to listen better and keep my own self-education going in that regard too.
Did your earlier work, do you think, reflected that your education in this sense had not yet progressed to where it is now?
I mean, yes. Short answer is yes. To some degree, always. Although, to be honest, when I look back over, you know, my first series was a sort of a young adult crossover series called The Chathrand Voyage, this great, huge, nautical, epic fantasy story. I try to look back and see things there where, say, I should have written in a more sensitive way about gender. And I don't know, this is going to sound very self-congratulatory. I expect to find places where I cringe. I don't usually. Now, you know, I'm hesitating here because I think the most important thing that a male writer can do is try to always be reflective and humble where this subject is concerned. I've just been thinking about feminism for so many years, for decades, really. I'm married to a very serious feminist scholar, a Marxist feminist scholar. And so it's always in my mind, it's always in my reading and in my thoughts to try to be serious about that and get it right. But, you know, I guess my hesitation is such that, you know, I think that the worst examples of sexism I tend to see are by people who are so sure they get it right. You know, so sure they get it right that they don't subject themselves to much examination. Mm-hmm. So I always want to consider myself a work in progress where that's concerned.
Okay. All right. Going back a bit to the building of the world for your book series. Now, I think we talked about this last time that you have traveled quite a bit in your life. How does that influence how you design the different nations and lands?
Well, I hope that it has given me a lot of subtlety in how I imagine people unlike myself. That's the best case scenario. And I think when I'm most satisfied with my work, I look back and I see that I've done that. What I don't usually see is a one-to-one connection between places I've been and lived and things that appear on the page. I mean, I think like a lot of experience, there's this whole, you know, theory of fiction writing that it's got to gestate for a long time. You need the right amount of distance. You know, if it's too lost in your past, you may lose the ability to write about it, you know, depending on, you know, how formative the experience was in a given place. But if it's too soon, you may not be able to write about it yet because it's, you know, you're too close. The feelings are too strong. You're still processing, you know, it's raw. And so when it comes to, say, Indonesia or Argentina or Colombia and these different places I've lived, it's usually a few years after I leave there that more direct traces show up in my work. Now, Master Assassins was something of a different story because I wrote that while living in Indonesia. And, but I was telling the tale of a arid desert portion of a continent, and that's not where I was living. I was living in the most humid tropical splendor spot imaginable. I was smack on the equator in the island of Java in Bogor, 50 miles south of Jakarta. And it was just dripping with vines and vegetations and flowering plants and so on. And, you know, it was literally called the City of Rain. And so I was not in a desert when I was writing about deserts. But, you know, what it did, it was also, it was a 90% Muslim community. So I was surrounded by people from a tradition so unlike my own. And I think that, too, just kept me thinking about difference and about what I take for granted all the time. And maybe that enriched the characters I imagined, you know. A big trick, I think, whenever you're imagining a new place, whether that you're imagining what it might be like to walk through, you know, the streets of Bangkok, if you're not from Bangkok, or whether you're imagining a secondary world, is to just stay alert for difference, for surprise, and think, you know, am I taking that for granted? Am I doing that without thinking how it might be different? And then make sure you don't.
Yeah. Like, if you're going to travel somewhere, really see the place. Don't just see the touristy stuff. See everything about it. Really get a feel. I feel like, yeah, if you can't really understand the place itself, the culture, the people, you're really missing on a lot of what makes it what it is. If you just stick to, the marketplaces and the tourist spots and the monuments, you're missing the stuff that makes it what it is.
And that's where I have to note my privilege has been so exceptional, Max. I mean, there's just no pussyfooting about it. I've been so lucky. I mean, of course, it was deliberate, too, that I worked in international development. That was a plan. You know, I thought fiction writing would be on the back burner for me until I was about 40. I actually got, you know how you make plans when you're 16, like, this is what my life's going to be like. In my 20s, I'll do this, and then I'll move on to that, and so on. So in my grand scheme, among many dreams that didn't happen, it was like, yeah, I'll keep thinking about fiction, but I'll really, you know, I'll get out of the Indiana Jones phase of my life and sit down to write those novels starting around 40. You know, that's when I'll have the cup of single malt scotch and the dog by my side and start inhabiting that. Well, I started a lot earlier than that, but oh dear, where did I start with this? No, I chose to work in international development and poverty alleviation work, and that created opportunities along with a whole lot of luck and privilege to live in places, not just visit them as tourists. And that makes, as you were kind of alluding, it makes all the difference. You know, when you're there day after day after day, you start to get to know people, you start to just see things around behind the shiny facades and the tourist zones, and you wander into just strange moments, you know. That's irreplaceable, you know. The wandering in the back streets of Buenos Aires and coming across, you know, someone rebuilding a car, and then you sit down and start talking to them, and you find out that they were, you know, in the resistance in the 70s, and that they watched their brother get picked up in the middle of the night and tortured to death, and you know, presumably tortured to death, never seen again, something like that. You know, you can't go looking for that, but if you live there, sooner or later it starts to happen. And yeah, stories like that just sink deep into you, and they kind of compost over time, and eventually they come out in your fiction, one way or another.
Hmm. Any places that are on your to travel to list?
Oh my, yes. Well, I have a really beloved cousin who lives in Kenya. And she's been there for a lot of years and has been asking me to come. I have yet to set foot on the continent of Africa. And I'd really love to go and stay with her for a good long while. So there's that. I'm really eager to get back to India, though that's not looking easy right now. It's just the horrible things going on there. But I have a lot of family there. You know, that's where my spouse comes from. And so that's... you know, as soon as COVID allows, I think she'll be going for a longer time, and I'll be joining her for some amount of time. But so many friends and family members there. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to go to Bhutan. I want to see forest elephants and forest rhinos and things like that. I mean, good grief, yeah. And being so stationary throughout COVID the travel bug is back with me now. I want to just jump in a plane, on a boat, just go somewhere.
I am counting down the days because I used to travel a fair amount, mostly in the U.S., but I am so looking forward to be able to get on a plane and to just go somewhere. Like, I have, like a list of places in the U.S. that I want to go to, and I'm just very much looking forward to doing that. Speaking of which, though, now that, you know, cases are dropping. We're seeing events resume. We're seeing a lot of things happening, mostly in the fall. Any plans to hit up conventions or book tours?
Mostly, it's still virtual at this stage because when I had to set things in place, you know, some months ago, it was still just too iffy to count on it. I am going to be in person at the KGB Bar in New York in November, assuming that November things are looking good. And I hope, you know, from mid-fall onward that they'll be able to be, that we'll all be able to see each other face-to-face and in the flesh more and more. I sure hope so, Max. I mean, thank goodness we can do these things from a distance, but I miss the community. I miss other writers. I miss getting beers with them. You know, I miss arguing with Jeff Ford elbow to elbow at a bar, and it's so many friends and readers and meeting them, just being out there. So yes, it can't happen too soon in terms of what I want, but it's got to be safe, and people need to, you know, there's a big question. The World Fantasy Convention is supposed to meet in Montreal in the end of October, right around Halloween. U.S. citizens have to quarantine for 2 weeks if they cross that border, if they're even allowed, you know. Is it going to happen? It's just, who knows, you know. Will the Delta variant that's got everybody scared today be changing all our lives just enough so that it's not a good idea to be going to a convention, you know? Yeah. Conventions were where the first scary stories about COVID popped up, as I recall.
This is true, yeah. I'm tentatively hopeful. You know, like I'm supposed to be going to the Rhode Island Comic Con this year, and that's November, so fingers crossed I can actually go there. And, you know, we were talking about Boscone earlier. Of course, that is next February if they go with the in-person event, and I'm hopeful that can happen too because I love going to that thing. The people that you can meet and the stories you can hear. It's a really, really wonderful event. So definitely,
well, fingers crossed.
Yeah, so definitely fingers crossed that we'll see. That we'll actually be able to see each other in person at some point in the near future. But I want to talk next about timelines, because there was a 3-year period between the first book and this one. And that's actually, you know, actually pretty short for a novel. I've heard some folks they'll take like 10 years to release. Did you set yourself any kind of a
deadline? Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, like 3 is actually fast, I think, in the novel world. I know like some writers put out books like every year, but that's like their full-time job. But my question to you is, did you set a deadline for this book? Did you say, okay, we're going to have it out in print by, you know, X year?
No.
Good.
I would love to be able to do that and still write a book that I'm, you know, proud of down to my toes. And I'm just not that kind of writer. I admire people that can do that so much. I admire their work ethic. I admire their incredible abilities. But, you know, we're all just so different in our wiring. And when I go faster than a certain speed, it starts to show in my writing. And then it's just sort of like built-in breaks. I slow down and, you know, I truly obsess about every sentence. So I try to put one foot down firmly and feel that it's well planted before I take the next step. And no, I mean, 3 years to write 672. I grabbed the book while we're talking and check on that. But it was a big brick of an epic fantasy, I can tell you. It feels pretty fast, yeah. But you know, publishers, they want it quickly, and I have some sympathy for why. 672, I was right. So, you know, if you take too long, you're going to lose some readers. They're going to drift away. You know that, and that's dollars out of everybody's pocket in the little ecosystem of publishing. You know, where unless you're huge, you know, unless you're Stephen King, the margins are kind of tight, and there's a lot of people not making a lot of money in the business trying to help you along. So, you know, it was not to put rose-colored glasses on about the, you know, the capitalism that makes this engine hum, but there are a lot of very, very good people who, you know, they're not trying to screw us over and say, you got to pump out a book every 12 months. they just don't want to be fired. And editors get fired if the, you know, if it takes too long and the returns are too low.
Mm-hmm. I think, though, the worst thing a writer can do is to say, okay, I will have this done by X date, because then they compromise. They say, okay, well, it's not what I wanted it to be, but hey, I met the deadline, so there you go.
I agree. Yeah. You know, it shows, and in any case, I can't do it. So it's, I just can't. Yeah. No. It's a tough world out there. I mean, on the other hand, if I didn't have some pressure, I would take too long. I know that about myself.
You know, I hear that. I hear that a bunch. Did COVID wind up giving you like a lot more time to write?
I'm sort of embarrassed to admit how little it changed my day-to-day life. You know, like everyone, I was staying out of public spaces, but I live in sleepy Western Massachusetts. You know, I live in the edges of Northampton, and a lot changed here and a lot didn't. I was in a lucky position where even at the very worst of it, I didn't feel like I had to stay indoors. You know, there were 25 walks where I could go and not meet a soul and walk my dog. And so it didn't give me more time or take away time. It made it much harder psychologically, because the things I would do to recharge my batteries, you know, connecting with good friends, seeing them face to face, going dancing, you know, just the silly stuff, being in a coffee shop so I'd have a secondary place to write, all of that was gone. And so I had to work hard to just not feel overwhelmed by the urge to get out of my chair and just bolt, you know, every day. So it changed the struggle, but maybe not in the ways that it did for people. Definitely not in the way it did in a big city, for example.
I myself found myself with not a whole lot of free time, actually, because I was able to, you know, like work full time. That didn't stop. I kept doing the show, of course, because everything I did was through like Zoom or Skype. So for me, I just recognized that I was very fortunate because I didn't lose, you know, a job. I didn't lose a house. I didn't have to worry about how I was going to like pay my bills. So likewise, there wasn't a whole lot of change for me aside from not being able to go to shows on the weekends. That was about it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. But those shows are important, right? I mean, and the shows and all those other things that, again, just sort of keep us feeling good. Those really matter, I think. Yeah. That was the hard part. I, you know, everything came down to screens, just screens and more screens and more screens. And yeah, I was teaching my classes only through Zoom, seeing every friend through Zoom, birthday parties through Zoom, like everyone in the world, you know. So, yeah, but I came through it healthy, and I hope you did too.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. Got, you know, both the shots, so I'm ready to get back out there and mingle with humanity. But speaking of pandemics, your book also has one of its own. The people of Urath wind up being trapped in a 300-year quarantine. So folks at home, it could have been a lot worse. You could have been home for 300 years. Did that wind up happening because of 2020?
Not at all, no. This is one of those cases where the plan was in place way before COVID. And I really want to get the word out about that. I am writing a plague story, but it was not COVID-inspired. It was creepy, though, to be right in the middle of telling this, and then here comes a plague. You know, here comes a pandemic. The name of my world plague, in fact, is the throat rust, and a inability to breathe is the big symptom. So I'm, you know, everybody on ventilators. This is just too real. This is just too close. And I'm glad that I can say, in all honesty, that all of that, I mean, Mass Assassins was written and published before COVID came along. And so I'm glad I can just say, yeah, it was all there before COVID came along, because it would feel funny to have just set out, you know, again, it would be too soon, I think. You know, we're going to need some time before COVID-inspired fiction really works, I think.
Yeah, I definitely have no desire to watch anything that involves, like, a new plague or some kind of bioweapon. I just, it's way too real for me. But
oh yeah, yeah,
but
I agree.
Yeah, but did you consider changing things because of just how close these two things were?
I didn't, for two reasons. One, the ship was sailing, and there was no the fundamental facts of how the plague exists in my world. There wasn't really any way to change that. But the other reason was that I was just very, very lucky in the kind of story I was telling, because in the world, you know, this series is called The Fire Sacraments. So, and the continent, as you mentioned, is called Urath. Urath is under quarantine because, or at least this is what they are told, because the plague has its origins in that continent. However, they have all evolved an immunity to it on the continent. Everywhere else in the world, it's absolutely deadly. And so they are told that they're being kept under this forced quarantine because all of them are carriers. And if anyone comes in or out, it could kill millions in the outer world. Now, there's a great question as to whether that is true or not, or completely true. And as the series evolves, and we find out a lot in Sidewinders that we didn't know in Master Assassin, we find out that there's another agenda, and there are people becoming very, very rich off of telling a certain story about the plague. And again, I don't want this to be interpreted as any sort of a commentary on COVID at all, because it's just different circumstances. So I didn't have to change it in a way because, you know, on the page, you don't see people dying of the plague because we're on the continent where everyone is supposedly immune. But we do see people dying because they're hungry, because they're under quarantine, because they're kept in a state of isolation from a world which, as we begin to learn, has got a lot of advantages that they don't enjoy in Urath.
So your release date is happening July 6th. Just a couple weeks away. How are you on release dates? Do you get nervous knowing that pretty soon you'll start getting the book reviews and the commentaries?
Oh, sure. I get nervous. I won't kid you. I'm not cool that way at all. I get nervous. But I mean, I think that I'm also at this stage, you know, this will be my 6th book coming out. I've got a pretty thick skin, and I'm realistic about what I can and can't influence. So I'm getting better and better at just letting that kind of thing go. If I'm nervous now, it's because I've really committed to being as active as one can be when they're not doing anything live. And I have a lot of events online, and, you know, I don't want to forget them, and I don't want to repeat myself. You know, I don't want people to be sick of hearing the name Robert V.S. Reddick before the book comes out, that kind of thing. So, and I suppose I was raised to not like talking about myself naturally, if you understand what I'm saying. You know, you're not supposed to make yourself the center of attention. But to publicize a book, you are supposed to make yourself and your book the center of attention. That's the whole idea, right? So I struggle with the sense of, you guys don't want to hear about that, right? You know, that sort of instinct. I didn't get into writing novels to be out there talking and talking and saying, me, I'm so fascinating. But I do it, you know, I know it's part of being a responsible author these days to do that. So,
yeah, exactly. Like when you put a book out, you're expected to do the readings and the signings and go to the conventions and the expos. Like you have to be like as much as you don't want to be, I'm awesome, everyone look at me. You have to do that exact thing, because otherwise no one's going to know you're out there and no one's going to buy your book.
Yeah. And you have to do it right around publication day, because for better or worse, there is a fascination in the reading world with what is new. I often think it's the bigger question, it's the more common question people ask than what is good. Honestly, it's just what's new, what just came out. And a few weeks after publication, you're not new anymore. And people are looking for what is. You know, people are going to be looking for what comes out on August 6th. not July 6th.
Yeah,
exactly. In late July. So you've got to do it. You've got to do it, you know.
Yeah.
And you just have to try to be honest and be real with people, I think. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about you, Max, actually, because, you know, last time we, I think I came on your show right after a great musician, and I got to hear some of that. And I know, you know, and I hear your conversations with other musicians and so on. Somebody said the other day, you know, that there's sort of the equivalent of a punk rock phenomenon going on in fantasy now, which is the self-published route, you know, that self-published books, they're getting to be seriously professional, if that's not sort of a contradiction in terms, but they're getting to be really good, real, and they're finding an audience at this just sort of gritty level. And, you know, those people would not say to you, you know, the sort of things I was saying of, you know, don't bang your own drum. They're like, hell yeah, I'm going to bang my own drum, and I'm going to find creative ways to make new people hear that drum. So, you know, I take some inspiration from that, and they're inventing all sorts of ways to put these books that don't have a big publisher behind them on the radar of the world. And so, you know, things have changed. I've changed to try as much as I can to go with that.
Yeah. I get you.
Punk rock. Maybe if I'm not a punk rocker, I sometimes sort of feel like a very minor David Byrne in the afterglow of Stop Making Sense and so on, who's, you know, people are already forgetting about him a little bit, but he's got this freedom to do exactly what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
I don't aggrandize myself by that comparison, but just that sense of, yeah, okay, they hyped me with my first books. They said I was the second coming, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't. That's okay. But it created, you know, a certain felt freedom in me to, you know, I can do exactly what I want and tell exactly the story I dream of telling. And that's a great, great thing.
Mm-hmm. No, it definitely is. It definitely is. Well, Robert, as always, it is a lot of fun talking to you. Definitely looking forward to reading the next book, which comes out, folks, on July 6th. You can get it online, in bookstores. And after this, though, Robert, what is next for you?
Book three, the third and last in this series. I've got to wrap it up. Book three is called Siege, and indeed the whole story is moving towards and culminating in the siege tale to end all siege tales. And that's going to be lots of fun to write too.
You're
going to see things go on there that, you know, hopefully have not been done before. Certainly not in my crazy way. So
I'll bet.
And then, you know, then I think I'm going to move away from writing series for a while. You know, I want to do some true absolute standalones. And I was telling you before we started chatting, this one is a standalone in some degrees. It's definitely part two of the story. But Sidewinders, you can read it alone, and I want people to know that. But when the series is done, I think I'm going to write some true standalones and see how that works. And maybe visit some old characters that I still love and think about from the first series. You know, I get a lot of letters, and maybe eventually come back and write about these folks again, the ones who are still alive anyway. We'll see.
Yeah, look,
feels like
that.
Long.
Yeah.
Thank you, Max.
Hey, you're very welcome. And for the folks at home, if you want to learn more about the author, you go to Robert V.S. Reddick, REDICK.com. You can find links to all of his socials, more info on his books, and definitely get your copy of Sidewinders, because it's going to be good. Robert, until next time.
Thank you so much, Max. It was just great fun.
Picture this. You finished your first book and nailed it. The plot, the characters, all the twists and turns. This one's a winner, and all you need is the right cover. If you've got my art skills, this is the part where panic usually sets in. Enter the cover villain, hero to writers everywhere. Founded by noted author Remy Flagg, Cover Villain focuses on composite image covers for science fiction and fantasy writers. Give them the details, and they'll craft a cover using popular trends that everyone will want to see. But wait, you say, I've got ideas of my own. No problem, as Cover Villain loves a good collaboration. As they say, our goal is to put a little villain in every cover we make. Want to know more? Then head to covervillain.com and follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Well, that brings this episode to a close. Big thanks to Robert for joining me. And don't forget, July 6th, the new book comes out. Be sure to get your copy.
You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to us on Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. And if you or someone else wants to be considered for the show, just message me at citywidemax@yahoo.com. As always, keep those ears open.